Blog Talk Radio.
Shalom, everyone. This is Rabbi Richard Address, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows represent our desire to explore issues and events that help shape and comment on the current revolution in longevity and how that revolution is impacting our families, ourselves, and our Jewish world at large. And we invite you to share your comments and ideas with us at Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com or on our Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. And we want to welcome for our first segment today, first doubleheader. Rabbi Judith Schindler, the director of the Stan Greenspun Center for Peace and Social Justice at Queen's University of Charlotte, a mouthful, and the Scholette Professor of Jewish Studies, and her website is judyschindler.com, and Judy Selden Cohen, who became a community advocate after 20 years in business, and you can find her on LinkedIn and on the author page of ccrpress.org. We're going to be discussing with the two Judys their brand new book published by the CCAR Press called Recharging Judaism, subtitled How Civic Engagement is Good for Synagogues, Jews, and America. And you can get that book from the CCAR Press or the Great God Amazon. And it's also, I think, available on the Kindle. And both are available, obviously, for coming to your congregation or your community. We'll talk about that in a minute. Wow, what a long introduction. Rabbi Judith Schindler, hi, and Judy Selden Cohen, hi, welcome. Thank you for joining us on today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. How y'all doing? Hello?
We're great. Thank you so much.
That delay. Listen, nice to be with you. We have so much to cover with this book. Very, very interesting book, just published. I got to ask you a question. The introduction is to the book, to Recharging Judaism, is by Susanna Heschel. And she talks about prophets and really alludes to the fact that the two of you, on the basis of this book, are you two considering yourselves prophets?
And I would never consider myself a prophet. I would love to embrace the prophetic voice. I think the role of the prophet is to disturb the comfortable and to comfort the disturbed. So I think we follow the prophetic tradition in challenging our community to look at systems and the ways in which systems are oppressive and to bring about justice.
So you state that the goal of Recharging Judaism is to encourage, this comes directly from the book, is, quote, to encourage more American synagogues to incorporate civic engagement alongside their traditional offerings of Torah, study, worship services, and acts of loving kindness. Rabbi Schindler, what does that mean?
Well, the traditional functions of a synagogue are Avodah and Torah and Gemilut Chasadim, worship and study of Torah and acts of loving kindness. But we believe that there needs to be a fourth pillar that sustains the congregation, and that is civic engagement, being involved in our community. That makes the synagogue relevant to today. There are so many unaffiliated Jews who find their meaning religiously doing the work of justice in the community and being engaged with the community. So we think for both the vibrancy of the synagogue and for the spiritual wholeness of the Jew who is out in the community doing this work, that the synagogue of today would be well advised to be out there engaged, creating minions on the move out in the community.
Judy Selden Cohen, you talk about civic engagement. Is civic engagement the same thing as what we, us old people, remember from the good old days of the 60s and 70s as social action? Is it the same thing, or is there a nuanced difference that you're trying to get at? Judy? Maybe we lost her. Maybe we lost her. Rabbi Schindler, could you just, you got me?
Oh, do you hear me now?
Okay. Yeah, there you are. There we, yeah. Judy, are you there?
I am. Do you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. We have a little, It must be the waves in Key West. Go ahead.
we throw around terms like social action and social justice, and over time, social justice has become viewed as a coded word for liberalism in some communities. And civic engagement speaks more to our obligation as Jews, our obligation as Americans to participate in the world around us.
But so unpack that for me. Let's be. There are a lot of colleagues right now who will want to. But I actually, literally on my way up here to the studio, just spoke to somebody about some of this. In March of 2018, may be tempted to get on the Bema and organize around laws dealing with guns, gun laws within their state, especially in the state of Florida, which may be perceived to be as a political action as well as a social justice, but also opportunities for community engagement. Are you talking about this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the book guides clergy on how to speak out on issues and not get so far ahead of the congregation that they don't take the congregation with them, but also to lead. And we explain how clergy, together with lay leaders, together with the congregation, becomes a cord of three strands from the text that's not easily broken when we stand together. And we guide on how to listen to the members of your congregation so that you pick up an issue that people care about and that people want to step outside the synagogue walls to speak out about.
We've all know situations, and when I was a regional director, we came up with this a lot, where somebody in the congregation, often a board member, will say to the rabbi after they gave give an impassioned sermon or are involved in the community, say, your job is not to be political. We don't want politics from the Bema. We just want Judaism. How do you deal with that within the context of recharging Judaism?
First of all, listening to the congregation to ensure it's not just the rabbi's voice, but the congregation's voice, hearing their passions, bringing them on board. When it is just the rabbi speaking from the Bema, then that is a claim of congregance. It's just the rabbi pushing these issues forward. But when it actually emerges from the grassroots of the congregation, like this issue of gun violence and our teens really leading the way, then you have that cord of three strands that Ecclesiastes speaks to, that a cord of three strands is not readily broken. So if you have the congregants, in this case our teens, caring about gun violence, and you have rabbinic leadership, and you have the lay leadership working together, that work is so much more powerful and effective. The other thing, in the book, we offer 10 words of wisdom for rabbis who have this passion and fire for social justice and the work of civic engagement. And we say that rabbis need to balance their sermons. If they're all political, they will alienate the congregation. There's a time for political sermons, and there are times for those sermons of comfort. People do want both when they come to the congregation. My father, Rabbi Alexander Schindler of blessed memory, had a formula, and every year on Rosh Hashanah, he would give a more political contemporary sermon addressing issues of justice of the day. And on Yom Kippur, he'd always give a more spiritual sermon. So I think the rabbi needs to be aware of the role of the synagogue and the need not only for inspiring people to be engaged in the community, but also to find the comfort which Judaism has to offer and the healing that Judaism has to offer.
Yeah, could you unpack those a little bit of those 10 tips for in from the book? It's titled 10 Tips for Success for Rabbis Leading Congregations in Civic Engagement. This is really important because, you know, having taught at HUC and knowing other people who've taught at seminaries, this is rarely discussed in a tachlis real way. of you know, how do you go out and organize your community to get to a point from point A to point B, bringing them along with you, and you know, can you just walk me through some of these 10 commandments, so to speak, these 10 tips?
Number one is do your homework. Don't just expect your congregation to understand why you're stepping forward on an issue. Doing your homework means writing a statement about why you're taking on an issue such as aging, because it reflects the congregation, because Judaism stands for supporting the elderly and honoring the elderly in our community, because the Reform movement takes that on as an issue for which they speak. So making sure that your leadership understands clearly and has the language to support you. Number two would be take congregants with you. Don't go lobby in your state capitol alone. Make sure you're making it a relational, congregational event. Number three, make sure you share what you're doing on social media and in bulletins so people can come with you through your teaching. Number four, make it an intercongregational experience. Build interfaith connections as you go with others in the community doing the work. Develop strong partnerships with your fellow clergy. That way, when you're not out there, they're out there, because caring and pastoring the congregation comes first, being for people in their moments of crises and joy. Number six, make sure you know when you should act independently and not do it in your congregation's name. Seven, make sure you have a clear policy in your congregation for taking on issues. Eight, emulate the House of Hillel. Respect opposing opinions. Just like the Supreme Court records the dissenting opinion, and we do in the Talmud, we always record Shammai's opinion, even though we might accept Hillel's opinion. We need to always respect and honor those who disagree with us. Nine, educate. If you don't take on an issue politically, you still can educate people about the issue and they can act independently. And lastly, that notion of really balancing the topic of your sermon so you're not political all the time, because people tire of that social justice voice all the time. No one wanted Jeremiah at the party when he was a prophet in ancient days.
The idea of knowing your people, I think, is so powerful. I do recall right after the shooting in Charleston, South Carolina, the church shooting, I was visiting the congregation there on the high holidays, and Stephanie Alexander, the rabbi there, gave a sermon about guns on the high holidays, and it was Rabbi Schindler, you would have been very, very impressed. She, in a congregation, a Southern congregation, with that culture of guns very prevalent, knew how to speak to her people. She did it brilliantly, and brought them to a place based upon the text. But it was really driving home this idea of you can do this with a congregation if you know how to speak with them, and they also have this sense of trust, which I think is very, very powerful. So Judy Selden Cohen, these 10 tips for the rabbis are followed by a very interesting 5 P's for lay leadership. And it's interesting that it follows in the same chapter here. 5 P's for successful lay leadership in energizing the congregation, recharging Judaism. Judy, can you walk me through why are you focusing and very, very brilliantly on the lay leadership role in this and these 5 P's? Walk us through that a little bit.
Thank you. 5 P's are essential because clergy have tremendous demands on their time, and we can expect our clergy to be the voice from the pulpit, the amazing voice from the pulpit. But in order to accomplish change, there's a lot of work that needs to get done, and clergy are pulled in many other directions. So having capable lay leadership to actually go do the work with the clergy is essential to success. So we, based on not only our own experience, and Rabbi Judy and I have collaborated on a number of congregational initiatives at our North Carolina congregation, but also based on interviewing 50 clergy and lay leaders across the country, we distilled five P's that clergy should look for when selecting lay leaders to partner with them. And they are passion, proficiency, personality, partnership, and pipeline. Because without passion, it just becomes another committee. And among the congregation, there are people who are passionate about the issues today. So finding someone for whom this is a labor of love is critical. But we also need someone who is proficient in the issues, because we don't want to mobilize our congregation to do something that's not going to make a difference. And so finding someone who understands what is feasible in today's world and what is not is huge. We need a personality who will mobilize other congregations, not someone who will drive other people away. And we need someone who will partner with the rabbi. We heard the most amazing stories of clergy lay leader partnership in our interviews. One lay leader said, "I would walk through fire for my rabbi." Another lay leader said, "My rabbi said, come with me to Washington, come with me to Israel. I said to her, tell me where to go. I will go with you." And frankly, Rabbi Judy's and my partnership has been an amazing one over more than a decade, in which we've been able to make change and write the book. And then finally, the issue of pipeline is one of sustainability. Volunteers burn out. Everybody has experienced this in synagogue life. And so having not just someone who's ready to step into the next issue, but having a path for clergy to identify who is willing to step up allows the synagogue to stay vibrant and active on issues of civic engagement. And some of the clergy we talked to had a very clear understanding of, you know, who to talk to and who to follow up with and how, frankly, to use the listening circles to not only identify what congregants care about, but who would be willing to step up and do the work. So we suggest that the clergy look for the five P's in order to move their issues ahead.
We're speaking with Rabbi Judy Schindler and Judy Selden Cohen, co-authors of a new CCAR Press book, Recharging Judaism, subtitled How Civic Engagement is Good for Synagogues, Jews in America, available through the press and also on Amazon. Rabbi Schindler, Judy, let me ask you a question, because Judy just referred to your partnership. What was the key pivotal point that you decided to write this book? Why did you do this?
For me, the issue was the one that you had referred to earlier about the board. Rabbi Judy and I collaborated on bringing a summer learning program, the Children's Defense Fund Freedom Schools, to Charlotte. We are the first Jewish-sponsored site for this program. We've worked on affordable housing, and our work catalyzed what has now a $20 million housing endowment to fund rental subsidies. But throughout this process, it was an art of dealing with the board of directors of our synagogue, and who has become very supportive of the work. But having a guide for other congregations to navigate those waters was a way for me to make that impact greater, because we can do what we do in North Carolina, but how amazing it would be to give this guide to other synagogues to do this across the country.
So very interesting. We're in March is when we're on here, and the Torah portions across the tradition deal with the Mishkan and the building of this temporary sanctuary, really a reflection back on the building of the Solomonic Temple, with chapter after chapter, a very detailed verse. And lo and behold, very interestingly enough, chapter 8 of your book really refers to the building of the Mishkan. And you use that imagery, and I'm anxious to hear you talk about that. Rabbi Schindler, why link what you're doing to this concept of the Mishkan in the wilderness. Talk to me about how you guys evolved that imagery.
The Mishkan, we have the model for creating that sacred space so that the sacred work of prayer and building community can come together. And so it is with the blueprints of social justice. We want to do the work. We have rabbis who feel passionate about these issues and want to get out there and do the work, and they're having a hard time bringing their congregations along. And so based on our research with more than 50 interviews of congregations, from leaders in congregations across the country, we created four models for doing the work, four models of Mishkans. Mishkanei Tzedek, Mishkans of Tzedek, Mishkans of Justice, sanctuaries of justice for doing this work. And that will make it easier, because if you just race ahead and start giving sermons and get out in the community but haven't done the groundwork that's necessary to make this work succeed, then your work will be in vain.
So, interestingly enough, as the Torah portions talk about the clothing of the high priest in the Mishkan, a lot of text is dealing with the breastplate. Lo and behold, in the book, you have this graph on page 200, actually, called the Breastplate of Congregational Diversity. That, I imagine, for some people springs a lot of interesting imagery to them. But what do you mean by this Breastplate of Congregational Diversity? Judy?
So the leader of the work. Okay. You go, Judy. Sorry.
The breastplate illustrates the importance of listening to the entire congregation. So the high priest had this breastplate with gems representing the 12 tribes. And in our congregations, we have to think about the diversity of opinion among the congregants. And so we encourage our readers to actually fill in the 12 boxes and not just listen to the Social Justice and Action Committee and the board, but to think about sisterhood, brotherhood for sure, but also issues of age, issues of ability or disability, interfaith households, environmentalists, and even, frankly, be sensitive to the political affiliation differences among the congregation. By taking the time to articulate who is in the congregation, we give ourselves a checklist to make sure that we hear all the voices among our membership.
And listening to those voices, you also carry through an image, Rabbi Schindler, with the Hebrew word vayisu, and they journeyed. This a rabbi and a congregation in many ways is a journey, I guess, continuing the major metaphor of our whole of Jewish tradition, and that is the journey in the wilderness. But what do you mean by the use of this concept of and they journeyed vayisu in the growth of civic engagement with the building of this, in essence, Mishkan of civic engagement? What are you looking for?
Someone once said that all organizing is, Judy, you could finish this quote. Do you remember this quote? All organizing is disorganizing and reorganizing. Do you have the quote?
Yes. Stephen Gacon, yeah.
So it doesn't, you can't just set up the structure once, right? And it's good to go for the rest of your career. With each issue, you need to go through the process of listening to your congregants and hearing what they care about and doing the education necessary, determining your strategy, setting your goals, embarking on actions, and then reflecting and evaluating and going through the cycle of civic change and social change again. So it's not as easy as setting up the Mishkan and having the Avodah, the prayer inside, work perfectly and the offering of sacrifices work perfectly. We are constantly setting up our Mishkan and then having to dismantle it as we move forward to either take on a new issue or pick up another significant piece of the puzzle with the issue we're working on. So with seniors, for example, we might work on healthcare and then we're working on transportation and then we're working on housing. Or we might have one win in the realm of healthcare and want to move forward and gain another win and broaden the accessibility for our senior population. So that's why it is Vaisu, because it is constantly a journey of figuring out how to be most effective. The leadership, the civic leadership of our communities is constantly changing. And so we need to regroup and reassemble our work as we work with new leadership in our communities.
I would imagine that in your research and from most of our experiences, the concept of the journey metaphor is understanding that you can move two steps forward, but you may then have to move three steps sideways before you continue that journey, even sometimes a step backward, because the journey is never linear, regardless of where we are. It's never linear. It's in many ways just all over the place, which is, you know, again, why the Jews probably took 40 years instead of going the express route. The one of the fascinating things we've discovered, and it's one of the workshops that we do out of Jewish Sacred Aging, is this explosion of ritual and the need to have some sense of ritual associated with, in our sense, new life stages. And yet here and in your book, Recharging Judaism, you have a bold section of text dealing with the question, is a blessing appropriate for civic engagement? What did you mean by that? What did you mean by that, Judy? Hello?
Which Judy? You want Rabbi Judy or?
No. We're Judy Selden Cohen.
So one of the issues that we were addressing with the book was, is this just for Reform synagogues, or is this for Jews across the spectrum of streams of Judaism and Jews who aren't affiliated at all? And our intent with this this text study, if you will, of do we say a blessing when we make an act, was to bring in voices of Orthodox voices, conservative voices, Reform, Reconstructionists, so that each person reading the book, regardless of their ritual traditions, regardless of their observance traditions, they could read this and understand how different Jews view this work of civic engagement.
I think it's important that people do understand that this book is not just for a specific movement. This is non-denominational. That is really a blueprint in essence for community organization based upon embraced by Jewish texts and traditions. So, which is why I wanted you to, you know, why I wanted to raise that question. So the Lubavitch congregation down the street and the Renewal congregation down the street and the unaffiliated Chavura up the road, who wishes to do this, can take this, take a look at the imagery, and use this as a blueprint for their own type of communal organization without and based upon their own culture, which is obviously important as well. One of the last questions, because we're about to run out of time for this segment. A lot of the instances and a lot of the references that you do in the book are fairly well-established congregations. How does that congregation of 100 families in the middle of, let's say, Florida with no support network, Jewish, how do they translate this with no staff, perhaps one rabbi and part-time administrative assistant? How difficult is it to translate this to their culture and environment? Rabbi Schindler,
well,
could you answer that? Go ahead.
We definitely have examples in the book of small congregations, beautiful congregations. They used these same models for moving their work forward. There was one great congregation that had a retreat, a congregational retreat, and they explored issues of justice, decided upon their issues of justice. And from their work, we created the model. Judy, did you want to speak to that congregation?
The Wisconsin congregation was amazing what they could do in a small congregation. The other example is we talked to a congregation in Tallahassee that joined with other synagogues and churches and mosques in their area and worked together to make change. And that was how they brought more resources to bear and amplified their synagogue voice to make change in their community. So we intentionally talk to red states, blue states, big congregations, small congregations, small cities, large cities, so that everybody could say, oh, if they can do that, we can do that.
Right. And that's why I'm glad you mentioned that, because the idea of working in coalition really sends a variety of very, very powerful and positive message, especially in this day and age, that you don't necessarily have to do everything alone. So thank you. Rabbi Judith Schindler, director of the Stan Grunsman Center of Peace and Social Justice at Queen's University of Charlotte, and Judith Selden Cohen, community advocate and organizer. Thank you for joining us. The book, Recharging Judaism, subtitled How Civic Engagement is Good for Synagogues, Jews, and America, available through the CCR Press, but also on Amazon. And we want to thank you both, Judys, for joining us. Continued good luck and success in your work with Recharging Judaism. I appreciate it very much. Have a great day and continued success. Thanks. Thanks, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Welcome back to our second segment here on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio and podcast. And we are very happy to welcome, through the magic of technology, Rabbi Stephen G. Sager, the director of SIHA. Steve, are you there?
I am.
Hey, great to hear your voice. How are you?
Thanks for the invitation. I'm doing just fine.
And you're located in North Carolina?
Yes, in Durham, North Carolina.
It's a big North Carolina day because Rabbi Schindler's up the street in Charlotte. And
yes.
So you're involved with SIHA. Let's get right to this. What is SIHA? S-I-C-H-A, for those of you who are not writing in the Hebrew.
Yes. SIHA means conversation. And SIHA is a project where the premise and the program really are the same. It is about enabling conversation. The name says just exactly what it is. Conversation between ancient texts, or shall I say better, classical texts, texts that through the centuries have carried the ideas and values and aspirations and problems and inquiries of Jewish life. Those texts in conversation with the living experience of people who inherit those texts as a legacy, and who oftentimes do not feel like worthy conversation partners with those texts. There is, in some ways, a discrepancy between how it is that we conduct our own lives, how it is that we reach into the matrix of our Western liberal, democratic, egalitarian upbringing, that legacy of ours, to make our decisions. And we don't reach into the Jewish world quite so much, and if at all, for whatever reasons, growing up in a secular society, not being skilled and schooled in the ancient texts or in the classical texts altogether, we suffer from something that might be the equivalent of math anxiety, you might say, in a certain way, that, I can't really engage those texts in conversation. I'm not a worthy conversation partner with them. But I don't believe that that's true. In my 32 years as the rabbi of a conservative synagogue in Durham, North Carolina, were the laboratory within which I proved time and again that it was possible for people to have conversations with their traditions, to add their own voice to those traditions, to let those voices make a claim, but also listen respectfully. Engaging a tradition or a text in conversation does not mean capitulating, folding your hands politely and saying amen, and accepting the authority of those texts. A lot of folks in my religious world, I dare say in yours, grew up not within the precincts of responsibility, mitzvah as the obligation that you must, to which you must adhere, but rather those people are looking, so those people are not looking for, we are not looking for obligation as much as inspiration. And these texts are worthy traveling companions. So Sicha is about the conversation and enabling the conversation. I think everything in Jewish life is really at stake. Our creativity, our imagination is at stake in the conversation.
So like you said, you mentioned this, you used your congregation as a laboratory. Was there a moment that you decided, I have to take this desire to expand these conversations beyond my congregation, and you created an organization? What was that pivotal point? What was that turning point that made you move from congregation to really branching out into creating this concept and organization called Sicha? What was it?
Well, thanks for the question. I had been in my congregation for 28 years. And during that year, a number of things happened. This actually is an acknowledgement of the sacredness of your project, I would say. You'll see what I mean in a second. During my 28th year, my father died. My daughter, our oldest child, became pregnant with her first child. And my youngest graduated from college. And I realized that there was a set of skills and aspirations, high and deep, that I felt like I was being invited by the universe to take someplace to some other level. Mm-hmm. I loved the life of the rabbi in the congregation. I had plenty of energy for it. I did not leave because I was burnt out or burnt up or bruised in any way. I'm still a member of that congregation. I'm the rabbi emeritus of that community. The rabbi who succeeded me was a member of my rabbinic, of Sicha's rabbinic enrichment program. It's a wonderful place to be, and I love being here, but it was at that point that I realized I pulled myself from the bar mitzvah schedule and from the liturgical schedule altogether and create a different rhythm for myself, that at my stage and age of life, with my skills and my background and my inclinations, that I should do something else that grew out of the work of being the rabbi of the congregation. So there you have it.
No, listen, in the work that we do in Jewish Sacred Aging, one of the texts that we always go and teach is Genesis 12 and the Lech Lecha. And mm-hmm. I always ask, you know, the people in the group, I said, go to the paragraph ahead of time and look at what happens to Avram's father, Terah, who dies. And I said, how many of you have mm-hmm. made life-changing decisions after a momentous moment in your own life, which in essence gives you permission or opens a door that you didn't or weren't ready to acknowledge before? And almost everybody has a story. Everybody does have a story. So these Lech Lecha moments, I think, are very, very, very powerful. And like you said, it's not burning out. It's like lighting another fire. So you created Sicha. And Sicha is a project, as you write, to simulate conversations between classic Jewish culture and contemporary Jewish needs. How are you doing that? Retreats, seminars, webinars, individual engagement? How are you inviting, facilitating these conversations between the tradition and the now?
Well, many of the above. The webinars is just that part of it will just be starting soon, but retreats and workshops, both for lay people and for rabbis, scholarly workshop leading, facilitating for rabbis, one-on-one work, especially with rabbis. This is a special project for me, the work with rabbis, because rabbis are the ones who are the change agents who are able to initiate conversations with people. So there are plenty of projects, Sicha projects, that are continued laboratories, as it were, that mm-hmm. do work with, are offered to lay people or mixed audiences. Our retreat in the mountains of North Carolina every summer draws both rabbis and lay people who learn together and our fellow travelers on whatever the theme might be. But of special and growing interest to me is the rabbi, and the rabbi as the change agent, the rabbi who's the who stands at a place at the intersection of the intellectual and the spiritual, where there are conversations that are always ready to happen and are always morphing. They're always changing, because as the rabbi matures and seasons, gets older in her or his role and her or his life, where life actually becomes a primary text in ways that maybe it hadn't been before, there are new avenues, there are new approaches, there are new texts that become interesting and new contexts that become compelling. And to invite rabbis to mine their own personal experience is extremely useful, because it makes them better fellow travelers. Sicha as conversation means exactly that. It means conversation. It does not mean PowerPoint. It does not mean the authoritative, magisterial, august presentation of something that I know that you need to know. From conversation, everybody emerges in a more fulfilled and more enriched way. So to help rabbis step outside, as it were, of their own authority is extremely important. And I try to model that and present it. And in our annual retreat and in other kinds of gatherings, and there are other gatherings as well, following another theme that I can tell you about if you want to know, in which I lead lay leaders and rabbis come to watch, there is a certain kind, or to participate, there is a kind of modeling there. It's good for me, it's good for communities, it's good for the rabbis who watch. I'm always surprised and enlightened, and I suppose at the heart of any teacher who at least thinks he's a good teacher or she's a good teacher, there is an imaginative and eager learner. I'm very eager to honor what other people bring, other people's insights and other people's stories.
We're speaking with Rabbi Steven Sagar, the director of Sicha, an organization that Steve founded to promote this conversation between classic Jewish text and, as you just mentioned, our life as a primary text itself. Steve, if somebody wants to find out more, the website, how does one contact or get information about Sicha?
SichaConversation.org is the website. And through that website, it's easy to figure out how to get in touch with me.
And this is non-denominational, correct?
That is right. That is right.
So this...
I have worked...
Go ahead.
Yes.
No, go.
I've worked with rabbis in our program that we call Sichat Rabbanim, Conversation Among Rabbis. I've worked with rabbis who are graduates of the Hebrew Union College and the Academy for Jewish Religion and the Ziegler School and JTS and the Reconstructionist College and HUC and JIR. This is not a denominational issue. The conversation is trans-denominational, post-denominational.
You write in one essay about the intersection of the personal and public life of the rabbi is crowded by the convergence, great word, of the emotional, spiritual, and intellectual aspects of a rabbi's life. What do you mean by convergence?
Yeah.
What do you mean? What do you mean by that?
I mean that I'm leading Kaddish as a matter of course, as I have in the synagogue or in the minyan every Shabbos for months or years, and then my father dies, and I'm both leading Kaddish and saying Kaddish.
And that?
I finally have a child who has become a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah. Pick your life cycle moment. Pick your theme where the parsha intersects with something political or culturally powerful and present for you. There are convergences. There is the bringing of my own life. I leave home with a toothache, and maybe I've had a crossword with a child, but by the time I get to the synagogue, I am still that person and also another one,
right.
Or also have to highlight other parts of me.
The convergence is a great
word.
Yeah, that's a great. It's a great concept because we've all walked that walk. And in the rabbinate, as you go through the life cycles and just your own maturation process, and as you said, and experience those life cycle events that you've participated in with other people, but now when it becomes your family and you personally,
yeah.
the world does change, and there's no substitute. And you can't teach this in school. You can't teach it, because I've taught at HUC. You can't teach it until you live it. One of the programs that you go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying amen to what you said.
Oh, I'll take an amen anytime. The more the merrier. We should have amen cards and just give them out. It's not a bad idea,
right.
Actually, it's not a bad idea. I have to remember that.
No.
Little amen cards, better than prayer cards.
I'll remind you.
Or trading cards.
Yes.
Let me get back to the... One of the projects I think you just alluded to that I do want to explore, because there seems to be an increasing need for it as the nature of the rabbinate has changed dramatically, at least in my tenure, is this mentoring program that Sicha runs. Talk to me about that. What is it? What are you trying to do with it? How does a colleague get involved with it?
I'm interested in the intellectual and the spiritual life of the rabbi and helping rabbis to mine their experiences such that they are illuminating their own manuscripts and the manuscripts of these texts that ostensibly are there as paradigms for us. Everybody who participates in our program participates through a theme that she or he has chosen. I'm happy to tell you about a couple of those themes by way of example. People can find this in the Sichat Rabbanim section of our website. It's all rather public, and it's all absolutely public, including the names of the rabbis. I don't need to mention, but I will tell you what some of the themes are. One rabbi said, "My question is, what happens to the voice of God after prophecy is closed? Do we hear the voice of God? How do we respond to the voice of God?" Well, this is a really extraordinary question from someone who is tuned in to that which is high and lofty, the aspirational claims of Judaism, who is also a social and political activist of a rabbi, who wants to know what happens when I have a burning idea that needs to be then taken to the budget committee. You know, how do I negotiate that? Do I compromise? Does one compromise with the divine voice? How do I hear it? How do I act upon it? What is my sense of obligation? Well, rabbinic tradition has a long, long set of inquiries into this. The bat kol, the divine voice that is a voice of not of authority, but of inspiration. And it appears time and time and time again. Modern Jewish philosophy and modern Israeli poetry. I'm really quite the devotee of modern Hebrew poetry, especially the poetry of Yehuda Amichai. And my academic work, my doctorate is in Midrash, so these are the Hebrew poetry and the Midrash are my two favorite areas. We spent 2 years learning about the bat kol and voices of inspiration rather than authority. And it made her a better teacher, a better leader, a better rabbi, a more enthusiastic fellow traveler. Someone else was interested in faith. I don't know about faith. I sometimes think I have it. Sometimes I think I don't have it, and I'm pretty sure, in fact. The problem is my congregants always think I have it. My Christian colleagues always think I have it. And I don't know whether faith is the same thing as belief. And I don't know whether I am entitled to or required to really unlock the rituals and carry the rituals which seem to depend on faith if I don't feel like I have it. So we spent also 2 years. The Sichat Rabbanim program at the time was a 2-year program. Now it's a 1-year program with some other options, in fact. But we spent 2 years. The first year was all learning one time a week during the academic years. And then the year and the next year was the development of a project that put into play what we had learned. So there are a couple of examples. And what's interesting to me is that kind of development. I think that this sort of mentoring and this sort of engagement, conversation, is different from coaching. I say it with all respect to the coaches and to the projects of coaching. But to me, coaching is more like what happens when the when the review committee says, of course we're going to renew your contract, we love you and we want you to grow with us and lead us, people do feel that you do, your Divrei Torah are a little bit too long, you don't return phone calls quickly enough, eye contact is a problem, hospital visits, people aren't so sure that you visit the hospital enough, and you don't have a big enough social media footprint. Well, those are matters that can be addressed. They're vital and they are of concern. They're part of the larger patchwork. But those things are matters for coaching, I think, as opposed to a kind of larger, deeper exploration that I'm suggesting.
So this is more of a spiritual mentoring rather than a practical mentoring, if I could try to
yes,
make it a distinction.
Yes, that's right. Although it percolates up, it certainly percolates up. There is, if I can give you one more example, one rabbi was interested in doors and doorways, thresholds, liminal moments. This came about after he got married and put up a mezuzah that he had taken from the place where he lived when he first got married out to where his first job was on the West Coast. And he put up the same mezuzah on a different door, and he called me and he said, it's the different door, but it's the same door. And there's something very deep about that. And we spent a long time. We spent 2 years, as it happens, learning about doors and doorways and mezuzot and transitional moments and Elijah the prophet as the character in the doorway, the one who presides over the transitions and so on. But it wasn't long before he went to the hospital and found there that as he walked up and knocked on the door of the room that his heart was pounding because he wasn't sure whether this person would be alive or not. He had responded to a call from his office to please go to the hospital because so-and-so was dying, and he didn't know, and nobody answered the door, and indeed, when he walked in, he found that his congregant had died, and there he was in the hospital room and waiting for the children to arrive who didn't yet know that their father had died. So this was a story that he told me, and at the end of an hour, he said, oh, we didn't read any of the texts. And I said, well, the truth is today you were the text. This was about you opening a door, discovering a new reality, being inside that reality, welcoming in and comforting at the same time people who needed to be part of that reality. But as long as they were on the outside of the hospital door, their father was not, as it were, dead. Only when they entered the room was he dead, and you were there. Baruch haba. Blessed is the one who enters. Well, yes, conflicted and more difficult, densely packed. So sometimes the rabbi becomes the text, and it becomes rather holistic. In any of these themes, as you can imagine, the liminal moments maybe being the best example. How is it that we move people from before Shabbat into Shabbat, or from the end of Ne'ilah, at the end of Yom Kippur, back to the regular world, even, a transition to which maybe we don't pay that much attention. So, thanks for asking. It's a really great question. It's very, very rich, because we are interested together in learning, and in a text-based learning, but sometimes we are the text. And while I provide a lot of the direction, that's my job, I don't provide all of the answers. This is a conversation. I don't provide answers because somebody else's experience is different from mine, and somebody's reading is different from mine, and somebody remembers, you know what, when I was in rabbinical school, I read this, which is now coming back to me, and I remember that I really liked it, and I wished I could have spent more time with it, and now here it is. How about that, based on my question of what's interesting to me? I didn't spend more time on it then because I was on this train, this express train through rabbinical school, and you have to move on to the next class and the next paper and the next text and the next assignment. But I'm reminded now that I really loved it. And right. So I hadn't read that text, and all of a sudden it comes back.
In the mentoring...
Oh, I'm going on too long, Richard.
No. In the mentoring, Steve, I just want to get this out before we start running out of time for this segment. You do the mentoring, or do you have a cadre of colleagues who then are assigned to colleagues who sign up for the mentoring? And I guess this is the obvious question if somebody's listening to this and wants to pursue it. Do you do this for free, the mentoring, or is there a fee?
I'm the only one who does it.
Okay.
At least right now. And there is a fee for it, and all of that information is on our website. The truth is that my fundraising efforts are enlisted in the service of making it possible for those fees to be negotiable, because hourly time, or you know, the time that it takes to develop this and to do it and to respond and to be there for people when they call, and those things that are not part of the normal rhythm of our studies but happen anyway, that gets to be more than people have in their continuing ed budgets. So the fundraising efforts are there so that people can do this because they need it and because they find it valuable.
How reluctant are you finding in working with colleagues, how reluctant are you finding these colleagues to be open and honest? Because we, as you know, we're a group of people, men and women, who in many ways are very, very well defended. Our deflector shields are up, and it takes a lot of trust to bring them down and say, I'm vulnerable in this. This is why I'm searching. Do you find that?
Mm-hmm. I don't really find it so much in the work that I do, because part of my work is to also be the exemplar and to be vulnerable. And for me, I'm not a therapist. I'm not, you know, there are also all kinds of interesting discussions in the literature, the professional literature of mental health professionals and so on about that. But for the rabbi, and for me, it's a different matter. So, I don't ask a question that I wouldn't answer.
Mm-hmm.
I usually volunteer the kinds of things that are trying or troubling to me or problematic about this text, and somebody else will help me, because my blindnesses or my demons even are not those of somebody else. So we rely on each other, and I find that it's true. It certainly is true not only in the individual relationships that I have with rabbis, but also when I work with groups of rabbis, because we are all there to struggle over and to try to tease out something that's important to all of us. And I try to make it clear that I really am not there to talk or converse with people about what I know, but what I want to know. It's about what I want to know. And everybody's expertise is welcome. So I try as much as possible to neutralize that kind of natural tendency to be competitive or to be defensive or something.
And you go out, you mentioned groups. So this is not only, you also are available to go out and speak with groups or work with groups, correct?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and in the near future, there will be a group in a small group that has asked me to do some learning with them and be a resource person for them in the southeastern United States and one in the northeastern United States. So, yes.
And once again, because we're just about to run out of time here on this segment, if somebody wants to get in touch with Sicha and avail themselves of your services and engage in this convergence conversation, how do they do that?
Yes. Sicha, S-I-C-H-A, conversation, all one word, sichaconversation.org. You can find it.
Easy question for the last question. We have about 30, 35, 45 seconds. What do you want in your dreams? Where do you want to take Sicha?
I would love for there to be a network of people who will do what it is that I do. I'd love for there to be groups of fellow travelers. I would love to be able
90
to
seconds.
Help other people figure out how to do this mentoring. I am developing a project precisely for that, so that this can be scaled, because it is something, going back to something that you said before, it's not easy to teach these things, but they can be modeled, and they can be taken in, they can be absorbed. And that's the plan. It's a plan in the making, and a plan that I'd love to talk with you again about sometime.
Thank you very much. Steve Sager, the Rabbi Steve Sager from North Carolina,
seconds.
Director of Sicha, this organization attempting to bring together the convergence of real life and our text and this conversation between text and who we are right now. Steve, thank you very much. Continued good luck to all of you. We thank you for being part of today's broadcast of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio and podcast. These shows will be podcasted and archived on our website, jewishsacredaging.com. I'll invite your comments to Rabbi Address at Jewish Sacred Aging, or again on the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. On the homepage, please feel free to contact us by using our special voicemail link. And again, a thank you to Steve Lubetkin at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media, which produces these shows. Thank you all for listening.
10 seconds.
And we look forward to greeting you again next week on the next edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio here on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Shalom.